Well, next Sunday morning we have John Stobbs with us, and John was with us while he was a student. And in 2008 he became the pastor at Penzance Baptist Church, and came as no surprise when John was with us. He felt there was a man who was being fired up by God and great graces and great gifts. So when I heard that he was going to become the pastor there, we were thrilled, and actually I preached at his induction. So it's lovely to have John coming back to us and preaching the word of God to us. So we look forward very much to John's visit next week. Well, please have the sheet open in front of you. Or your Bible open in front of you. Last Sunday we started a new series in Paul's letter to the Romans, to all those in Rome who are loved by God and called to be saints. And last week the question we addressed was, is why did Paul write the letter? What is the letter to the Romans really about? And the answer in a nutshell is that Paul is writing to unite believing Jews and Gentiles together into one church, one worshipping community at the heart of the empire to the glory of God. So what's going to unite them? There's lots of scattered Christians throughout Rome, but no clear church. Well, what's going to unite them is a true understanding of the gospel, a gospel with a Jewish root, a Jewish Messiah, but good news for condemned sinners everywhere. It's the only message to bring us to God, and it's the only message to bring us together. So Paul is writing to all those in Rome who are loved by God and called to be saints to lay the theological foundation and more to unite Jewish and Gentile Christians together into one church. And last week we said lots more than that. If you missed it or you want a reminder, then please get the CD or listen to it on the web. Okay, the gospel. So where does Paul begin? Well, he begins with the mess that we're in. Romans 1, verses 18 to 32. So please have that. We're going to follow Paul's argument. It's quite tightly argued. So please get your thinking heads on. And we have two things to say, two points. And point number one is this. The foundational sin of the human race. The sin from which all other sins come. What is our root sin? Where did it all go wrong? Verse 19. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. Now, can I see God? No. Paul says his eternal power, his divine nature, those things are invisible. Well, if they're invisible, how then do I know there is a God? Because those invisible attributes are clearly revealed in the world that God has made. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, the things you cannot see, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived, clearly seen, ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made. Now, do you like to be beside the seaside? In the old days, if you went to the seaside, you'd bring back a stick of rock. And the rock would have lettering all the way through it, Brighton or Bournemouth or whatever it was. Well, the creation is not a stick of rock. But wherever you look, says Paul, you can read the Maker's name. A name to inspire awe and wonder and worship. Is God big? Well, look at the size of the universe he's made. Is God glorious? Look at the sun. Is God powerful? Witness a thunderstorm. Is God wise? Witness DNA, a four-letter code giving rise to you and me. And is God beautiful? The beauty of holiness. Well, what would you choose among the things that God has made? For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived, clearly seen, ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made. So, says Paul, they are without excuse. No one can seriously say there is no God. But of course they do. Now, people are very religious. They may say, oh, I believe in this God, I believe in that God. But they don't believe in the God who is God. That's the point. They don't believe in the real God. So if it's all so obvious that God is, that people are without excuse, what went wrong? Verse 21. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Instead of worshipping God as God, instead of giving him the honor that is due to him, instead of looking up to their maker and giving thanks, we walked away. So the Garden of Eden, the very first sin, Adam and Eve, Genesis chapter 3. They've been told not to eat of the tree, the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And the serpent says to them, Genesis 3 verse 4, but the serpent says to the woman, you will not surely die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened. And you will be like God, knowing good and evil. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave to her husband, who was with her, and he ate. Then the eyes of both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. Here's the attack. Here's the lie. Here's the temptation. You will be like God. Don't let God choose, you choose. Don't let God tell you what is good and what is evil, you decide. Don't let God do your seeing, see for yourself. That's why it says of Eve, she saw. No longer is God doing her seeing, she will see for herself. And Adam and Eve, they turn away. They sin. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But of course, they're programmed to worship God. It's stitched into their very identity. If you like, the worship of God is the prime directive of a human being. So when they turned away from God to build a parallel universe without God, it was the ultimate lunacy. It was a looking glass world where everything is distorted, where nothing is as it should be. It's Paul's point, verse 21 and 22. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. So now they turn aside to this parallel universe, this looking glass world, but they became futile in their thinking. And their foolish hearts were darkened, claiming to be wise, to be enlightened. Now we see they became fools. See what he's saying? If you turn away from wisdom, there's no alternative wisdom out there, is there? Only madness. If you turn away from the light, there is no alternative light. Only darkness. If you turn away from the deepest reality of the universe, if you turn away from God, then you lose touch with reality. And how far is this insanity gone? Verse 23. We'll take from verse 22. And claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images. images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Think of it. Programmed to worship the splendor and majesty of the immortal God. Only then to bow down to images of the mortal. Exchanging God for godless. Exchanging the real for the false. Images of man and chickens and cows and crocodiles. Man who once named all the animals. Made to be king over the creation. Now bowing down to statues of animals. And that is the fundamental sin of the human race. It's idolatry. Hardwired to worship God, but exchanging the worship of the real, the worship of God, for gods that are not real. And in the West, verse 22, we make claim to be wise. Because we no longer worship sticks and stones. But we're still fools. Still idolaters. Ours is a society that's full of worshippers. Because that's where we're hardwired. We don't even know we're doing it. We all serve someone, something beyond ourselves. And we look to that service of that someone or something to make sense of our lives. Do you follow what Paul is saying? If we don't worship the true God, because we're programmed to worship, we worship our own gods. And that's the madness, because those gods aren't real. Money, success, pleasure, sport, children, adrenaline, movie stars, rock gods, food, the worship of myself. And they give our lives meaning. We show them reverence. They comfort us in our sorrows. They take our time, our money, our energy. And of course, in the end, they desert us. They kill us. The basic sin of the human race, our basic sin from which all other sins flow, the prime sin, the beginning of the sin, is idolatry. Exchange the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. Verse 25, they exchange the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature, the created, rather than the creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. And of course, when we stop looking up, we look down. And when we stop looking outside ourselves to God, we curve in on ourselves. But in case we start feeling sorry for ourselves, Paul says, in our looking glass world, we refuse to face up to things. That's what he's saying in verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness, ungodlikeness, and unrighteousness of men who, by their unrighteousness, suppress the truth. We bury the knowledge of God. Programmed to worship him, we bury that knowledge. We deliberately suppress the truth. You can buy isolation headphones. It's used by musicians to suppress the level of external sounds. So all they hear is the music that's being piped in to their ears. So you can play along without any other distractions. Well, we choose our godlets, our little gods, tiny, tedious gods. And we make them the soundtrack to our lives. And then we put on the isolation headphones. We suppress the truth. We shut out any other sound. We shut out the Maker's voice. And we are without excuse, says the Apostle. So idolatry. It's the fundamental sin of the human race. So point number two. God's response to our sin. Verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who, by their unrighteousness, suppress the truth. Now, Paul speaks of unrighteousness. It's the language of the courtroom. So who's in the dock? Well, we are, the human race. Who's bringing the charges? God himself. And of course, he is right and we are wrong. He is righteous and we are unrighteous. But instead of repenting, instead of returning to God, we press on in our wickedness. We suppress the truth. We defy God. We seek to inflict personal injury upon him. And what is God's response? God is angry. An anger that is revealed from heaven. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who just keep on and go further and faster, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. Okay, Paul, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven. But where is it? Because if you look up this morning, there's no burning sky. Where is it? Where is this wrath? Well, says Paul, you see it every day. Verse 24. Therefore God gave them up. Verse 26. For this reason God gave them up. Verse 28. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up. Three times, says Paul, God gave them up. If our fundamental sin is idolatry, if that is our crowning sin, then God in his wrath has given us over to sins that fit the crime. Sins which hurry us to our final destination. Now, what do we mean? Well, let's look at Paul's argument. First of all, in verses 24 to 27, listen to what he says. Therefore, God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. And men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty for their error. Now, what's going on? Is Paul sort of outraged of Tunbridge Wells? When he says that, it's this sort of Daily Mail headline. Now here's Paul, verse 24, and he's raging against promiscuous society. And then when he gets to verses 26 and 27, he's really warming to his theme. This unnatural wickedness. Is Paul anti-gay? Is he homophobic? Does he hate all sin, but then this sin is the one that really makes him angry? Verses 24 to 27, is it just a rant? Well, this is the man who calls himself the chief of sinners. So whatever anyone else has done, Paul says, I've done worse. And this is the man who warmly befriends the gay community in Corinth. And many of them are converted and changed. So this is not moral outrage. It's an explanation of how God's wrath works itself out in human society. And why certain sins illustrate that better than others. So Paul is not, as it were, nailing sexual sins as being worse than any other sins. After all, the Lord himself said that the good religious people of Capernaum were far worse sinners than the people of Sodom. Paul focuses on these sexual sins to illustrate the revealing of the wrath of God on humankind. That's why he's doing it. They're illustrating his point. So let's follow Paul's argument. And we'll begin in Genesis 1. I need to turn to it. I'm going to read a couple of verses. Genesis 1. Okay, we come to the creation of man. Then God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. So to be human is to bear the image of God. And fundamental to that image bearing is maleness and femaleness. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God made man in two halves, male and female, so that together the two become one. And in that they reflect the three who are one, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, three persons, one God. He makes them two, so two become one to reflect the three who are one. That's why he makes them male and female. So maleness and femaleness lie at the very heart of what it means to be human, what it means to be made in the image of God. But of course, how do a man and a woman become one flesh? They become one flesh through sexual intercourse. So our sexuality is key to our maleness, our femaleness, which in turn is key to our bearing the image of God. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. He says it twice. And what does that mean? Well, male and female, he created them. So any departure from maleness and femaleness, any distortion of our sexuality, is to corrupt in us the image of God. Paul puts it like this when he writes to the Corinthians. He says, flee sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body. But the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. See what he's saying? When we go outside the boundaries that God has set for the expression of our sexuality, when we go outside marriage, however that sexuality is expressed, then that is an assault upon our own nature. Let me explain. If I assault you, if I come and beat you up, all right? I won't, but if I come and beat you up, it's a sin outside my body, isn't it? I'm doing it to you. I'm beating you up. I'm attacking your humanity. But says Paul, if I commit sexual sin, it's a sin against my own body. I'm attacking my own humanity. In one, I'm attacking your humanity, the image of God in you. But in sexual sins, I'm attacking the image of God in myself. I'm attacking my own humanity. Okay, let's see how it plays out. Romans 1. Let's follow how Paul puts it all together. Okay, God's wrath is revealed from heaven. It's being revealed now, says the apostle. How? It's revealed by handing people over to sin. And notice, says Paul, is that better illustrated than in sexual sin. So verse 24. Therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to the dishonouring of their bodies among themselves. Talking about all sexual sin. Men, women, whatever it is. If we won't worship the God whose image we bear, then says God, you are not worthy to bear that image. And so he hands us over to sins, sexual immorality, which destroy that image. It's Paul's argument. Okay? To the dishonouring of their bodies among themselves. And then in verses 26 and 27, Paul moves from sexual immorality in general to homosexuality. For this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, for their women exchanged natural relationships with those that are contrary to nature, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty of their error. Now, the first thing we learn about ourselves is whether we're boys or girls, yes? Well, that's the first thing we come to a realization of as we're growing up. And the first thing we notice about others is whether they're boys or girls. So someone is coming towards you in the distance. They're a long way away. You can't tell whether they're tall or short, whether they're blonde or dark. Sometimes you can't even tell whether they're black or white. But you can tell whether they're male or female, even by the way they walk. It's the first thing we notice. Because maleness and femaleness are essential to our identity as human beings, beings made in the image of God. But, says God in his wrath, if you don't count me worthy of worship, that's the fundamental sin, then you are not worthy to bear my image. Do you see the connection? If you don't count me worthy of worship, then you are not worthy to bear my image. And so I'll hand you over to sins that destroy that image. That's what Paul is saying. It's not a rant. He's explaining what's going on. So for women, for this reason, God gave up to dishonorable passions. For women exchanged natural relations for those which are contrary to nature. God made women, female. He made it so that their very nature was to be a wife and a mother. Even women who aren't married can't stop themselves from mothering others. It's fundamental to womankind. That's her biology, her psychology, her sexuality. Well, says God, Paul hands women over to a relationship that is contrary to their nature. So the woman turns away from the fruitfulness of womanhood to the unfruitfulness of a same-sex relationship. And the same is true of men. And likewise, men likewise gave up natural relations with women and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the penalty due for their error. If you exchange the truth of God for a lie, then God, in his wrath, hands you over to a lifestyle where you exchange the natural for the unnatural. You exchange the truth for a lie. Your lifestyle becomes a lie. After all, if the human race ever reached a point where men and women turned away from each other and ceased to relate to each other as they were meant to relate to each other, then the human race would die out in a generation, wouldn't it? But you see Paul's argument. It's not a rant. Men committing shameless acts with men and receiving in themselves the due penalty of their error. Not AIDS. Not STDs. It's far more fundamental. It's the destruction of our humanity. That's what he hands them over to. The destruction of their humanity, bearing the image of God. Remember 1 Corinthians 6, the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. God gives them over to sexual sins, which ultimately in them erase the image of God and destroy their humanity. And the same argument is expressed and made in verse 28. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a debased mind to do what ought not to be done. Again, it's the unfolding of God's wrath, and it corresponds to the original sin of idolatry. God repays us according to what we have done. Verse 28, if you don't think God is worthy of your thoughts, then God will give you over to a mind that can't distinguish whether something is worthy or not. If you don't want great thoughts of God, then God will give you over to a mind that is filled with worthless thoughts. Minds without wonder. Minds that never look up. Minds that are debased. They look down. And as we think, so we live. Verse 29, they were filled with all manner of unrighteousness, evil, covetousness, malice. They are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, maliciousness. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boasters, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. So, Christian friends, the wrath of God is being revealed. It's being revealed from heaven. It's being revealed now. Not in a burning sky. So where is it? Says Paul, just look around you. Just look at human society. Just look at ourselves. Because as I go through that list, I'm guilty of all those sins. In heart, in lip, in life. Why do people sleep around? Why do they look at pornography? Why do they gossip and trash people? Why do they resent the success of others and feel sorry for themselves? Why do they argue with their parents and backbite and divorce? Why do children growing up in a Christian home resent that home? Why do people swear and hate and boast and refuse to say sorry? And get drunk, and take drugs, and fight, and kill, and maim, and lie. And we could go on, couldn't we? For a long, long time. And if you give someone a moral upbringing, they sometimes turn out even worse. Because they'll look you up and down, because they've become a self-righteous Pharisee. And they say, oh, I thank you, I'm not like these people. Why is society as it is? Why do we do all these things? It is because God, in his wrath, has given us over to these things. Therefore, God gave them up. For this reason, God gave them up. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up. And it is these very things, the very things we witness in the lives of others, in our own lives, those very things are the evidence of the unfolding, the revelation of the wrath of God upon the human race. Having rejected him, having thought him unworthy. Can you imagine it? Unworthy of my time, attention, worship. What says God, therefore, you are not worthy to bear my image. I made you in my image, but you've turned away from the Maker, so I will turn away from you. You are not worthy to bear my image. And so he hands us over to sins which will in time destroy that image. Sins that destroy all that's lovely and pure and good and noble and beautiful and true. If we don't want God's universe, we find there is no alternative universe. Only a hell on earth. It's the dog that snaps with uncontrolled fury at its owner. And the hand that feeds it is the hand that the dog bites. The owner loves the dog. The owner holds the lead. But you can't do anything with the dog. The dog is mad. And it strains at the leash all the time and longs to be free. So one day the owner slips the lead and gives the dog what it wants. And the dog is free and runs, barking and snapping and biting at all that is in his path. And it eventually runs into the road. And is killed. Therefore, God gave them up. It's me as a small boy running down the hill to the corner shop. I'm going faster and faster and faster, and I can hear my sister shouting, "Stop! Slow down!" But I'm not listening. I'm going faster and faster and faster until that awful feeling that you can't stop. And there's no one to catch you. Therefore, God gave them up. And we can't stop ourselves until it's too late. It's what God in his wrath is doing. He slips the lead. If we won't listen, then he lets us run faster and faster, helter-skelter, pell-mell to hell. And in case you think God's being too severe, look at verse 32. Though they knew God's decree that those who practice such things deserve to die, they not only do them, but they give approval to those who practice them. There's a kind of wickedness that just loves to be wicked. The pleasure is found in doing what is not allowed. We love our fall. Our motive becomes wickedness itself. It's Augustine, isn't it, talking about the pears that he used to steal. He used to go out as lads and they used to go pinching these pears from someone else's garden. Why did they steal them? Well, says Augustine, it wasn't because they were lovely pears. In fact, I had a pear tree in our own garden that produced much better pears. And in fact, we took far more than ever we could eat. So why'd you go stealing them? Ah, he says, you steal them just for the pleasure. Just for the pleasure of stealing. And that's what we've become. Our wickedness has become an end in itself. We take pleasure in being wicked. Wicked. And the sense is, God, stop me if you dare. And so Paul brings to a close the first part of his argument. And says, look at the mess that we're in. And therefore the only remedy for the human race is the one that God himself has provided. Which is why Paul says, I'm not ashamed. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. What a mess. But what a gospel. We can't finish this message without saying something about that gospel, can we? What a mess we're in. What a wonderful gospel. Several years ago in Mumbai, several bombs went off in a train, killing hundreds. One of those killed a young man by the name of Kunal. He was sitting in a crowded carriage when he saw a woman without a seat. So young men, being the gentleman that he was, he stood up and offered the lady his seat. And she sat down in his place. She sat down in his seat. And as soon as they swapped places, and the bomb went off. And the young woman, or the woman, saw Kunal blown through the roof of the carriage. What should have happened to her happened to him. And she later found him mangled and dying. An innocent man who gave up his seat, who gave up his life to save another. And that's the gospel. My friends, you sit here, and as you followed, I hope, Paul's argument, I hope you'll see. You don't need any more evidence, do you? But we're in a mess. You're in a mess. You're in a massive mess, aren't you? And you can't get out of that mess. And actually, it's not that God's anger is somehow waiting for you at the end of it all. It is. But God's anger is unfolding on you now. The reason you want to do all those things and live in that way is the unfolding of God's anger in your life. God is giving you over to those things so that you'll destroy yourself. You think you're being clever and free? You're in a mess. You're under the anger of God. But what did Jesus Christ do? He left his seat in heaven to die on a cross. He swapped places with the sinner. Mine was the crime, but he suffered the penalty. Mine was the guilt, but he suffered the wrath of God. Mine was the sin, but he suffered the punishment. And it was his life for mine. But not only did he pay in full for my unrighteousness, he left a seat to fill. So that all who come to Jesus Christ have a place in heaven heaven which begins now in this world. For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. My friend, you're running downhill to hell. You need saving. And you can't stop yourself. You need the power of God to save you. But you're under God's anger now. So you need the power of God for salvation today. You need the gospel today. And that good news of God's salvation is for everyone who believes. So what does that mean? It means now, this morning, running into the outstretched arms of Jesus. Let's sing a hymn.